Silence!
Oppenheimer!
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Play Radio!
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 127 of Nerd Pride Radio. 127, there are exactly 127 millimeters in an inch. Also, the average human hair is about 1/127th of an inch, or 1/5 of a millimeter. Ta-da! So, ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I am awesome! My name is Mike Jones. I am a D&D/Pathfinder nerd, a history nerd, a sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd. Plus, there's like 7 other kinds of nerd. I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You are listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my skull anymore. As always, you're listening to the best-smelling podcast on the internet. That's right. Nerd Pride smells exactly like, and I got 2 of them this week, because Kaz told me it smells exactly like burgers on a charcoal grill, which is pretty damn good, especially, yeah, Noah says that sounds delicious, especially if, like my dad does, he'll be grilling up the burgers and the hot dogs, and then on the side, there's always some cut-up chunks of kielbasa that are grilling off on the side. Oh, awesome. But the other, no, that wasn't Kaz. That one was Ronster, because Kaz said, peanut butter and bacon sandwiches. So hungry. Oh my goodness. Yeah, you guys would do this right after I decided to start my diet again. Man. But you know, peanut butter and bacon, you cannot go wrong. Best sandwich in the world. Well, okay, except maybe, grilled cheese with onion jelly. Also good. Anyway, I gotta stop talking about food. Before we do anything, guess what I got? That's right, I got a little feedback. This is actually from Mrs. Darks, Sarah Beth. She sent this to me a couple weeks ago, and it's kind of long, but this followed up my discussion of Star Wars The Force Awakens and my complaint that Chewie should have hugged Leia at the end instead of having Rey run up there. And she addresses all of this, and here is her take on the whole thing. So, and I'll probably, as I do, I'll probably butt in and reply to stuff as we go, but I'll try and do it justice here. So, she says, with not seeing the Chewie Leia grief hug, there are 2 reasons, one personal and one selfish, There are 2 reasons, one personal and selfish, and the one that, to me, makes sense for their characters. Okay, the first reason, apparently the personal and selfish one, she says, I would have broken into a million pieces and started sobbing uncontrollably if they had shown that, like I did when I saw Chewie Young Ben comic. Oh, God, have you guys seen the Chewie Young Ben comic? It is kind of reminiscent of a Calvin Hobbes thing, but it just, oh, man, it'll break your heart. Absolutely break your heart. I think Nerd Pride posted that. I think I put it out there on Facebook. Anyway, she says, talk about ugly cry. At my desk, at work, at first I was like, why? Why didn't they hug? And then I was kind of grateful. Okay, I get that. But again, I want to be true to the characters, true to the story. So let's move on to her reason number 2. Sarah Beth says, then I started thinking of that directorial writing choice. Here's my theory. We know Chewbacca is a sensitive, kind, and emotional kind of guy. We know he just saw his best friend get killed by his son. Then he has to continue on for the greater good. He does what many of us do, but to an extreme level I don't want to fathom. He has his first emotional outburst, where he shoots Kylo, obviously, and then squashes it down, puts it in a tightly lidded bottle until he can unload it later, and he does what he needs to do. That's the Wookiee he is. That's the hero he is. He does what he has to do. He does what Han knew he would do. And then there's a side theory here from Andrew. We'll get back to that one in a minute. Anyway, Chewie packs away his anguish and gets the kids back to the base. The base where everyone is celebrating because they frickin' did it. Yay! Even though they have some major losses to grieve, they know the greater good is served for the moment. The immediate victory is won. Chewie and Leia make eye contact to me, and I may be totally off base. These are her words. That look is an agreement between them. It says, soon. It gives that moment to Rey, a child who, in a matter of weeks, days maybe, has had everything, absolutely everything in her life turned upside down. She's never had any stability living day to day on quarter portions, but that at least was normal. All right? She's had everything change. Learning how to fly, met a hero, had him die, thinks it was at least partially her fault, and is now the target of an enemy who will have no issue killing her. She goes on to the only maternal figure that she sees for comfort. I don't think the Rey and Leia hug is as much about Han at all. It's about a scared, lost little girl needing someone to cling to. Leia's a mother, and she sees that need and responds to it. She knows how to hold her grief because it can wait. I feel like as soon as the party is over, so to speak, when things are quiet, before Rey and Chewbacca go to find lonely Luke, Leia and Chewie will have their time, hug it out, cry it out, feel the grief, talk old memories, and have their mourning out of the ugly public eye. I feel like we owe them that time, a single yet touching hug before moving on to other plot issues that need to be done. Hold on, I have to scroll down. Before the movie can end wouldn't be enough. Oh, okay. So the single hug between them and then immediately having to rush on to other things wouldn't have done justice to the emotion and grief between them. All right, I get that. Anyway, that's my two cents on that. Take from it what you will. Sorry for any and all typos. Once again, typing on the phone, I want to get back to that point as well. All right, first off, to address the major point that you feel like Chewie and Leia recognize this in each other, they will be there for each other, but this isn't the moment for it. Okay, I can get that. And I have no counter argument to that because that may well be justified by the film itself. And that's the only thing I ask, all right, is much like my complaint about Han has no idea what Chewie's bowcaster can do. He acts like this is the first time he's ever seen the bowcaster. I understand. Okay, maybe it was just upgraded. Maybe something just changed. Well, that's fine. And that would make perfect sense if the movie justifies that. If the movie gives us at least a hint that that's what has happened or what might have happened. But the movie didn't. As far as I can remember from the film, the movie at no point gives us any indication that there's something unique about the bowcaster from the last time Han would have seen it, which means, they've been together 30-something years. Han would have seen the bowcaster in use, would have known all about it. And so the idea that he's surprised that the thing is powerful, well, then give us something to show us that Chewie made a change to it. Give us something in the film to justify that explanation, because it's a perfectly logical explanation. Right, it fills in all those gaps and it's fine, but we have to see that. We have to have something that tells us that. All right, if we're required to make up a bunch of explanations ourselves, if we're required to justify the movie ourselves without any basis for it in the film, that seems a little weak, or like it was poor editing at some point. Maybe it was in there and it just got removed for time. Who knows what? All right, so same thing with the Chewie and Leia hug. If there's this idea that they're going to have their moment afterwards, as long as that's justified in the film, as long as we see some kind of connection, and maybe it was there. Maybe it was there in the eye contact that they gave each other. Maybe it was there, and all of this is perfectly justified. And it might be. I'll have to watch it again. Eventually, I will watch it again. So I will be looking for that among a million other things I'm going to be looking for in this film. So that is a really, really good point. I completely appreciate it. Thank you for sending it. Now, the other two things that you brought up, Sarah Beth mentions that Andrew has another theory here. And Andrew's theory is that because the lightsaber blow is not shown, Andrew thinks, and this is Andrew from Me Like Trivia, who apparently they're gathering information for season two. So hopefully season two is coming soon. Of the Me Like Trivia podcast. So watch out for that. If you're not listening already, go back and listen to all the previous episodes of Me Like Trivia, and then when the new one comes out, hey, you'll be all caught up. But anyway, Andrew says, since the lightsaber blow is not shown, that Han actually activated the weapon himself for the love of his son. Sarah Beth says that she hasn't fleshed this out for herself, and she's very emotionally invested in these, and that would be a hard one for her to puzzle out, so she hasn't really thought about it yet, at least at the time of this writing. I will say that I think that is – I don't think that that's supported by the narrative in any way. That would be really, really cool in some ways. But I don't know if it's justified by the kind of person that Han is. The idea that Han would commit suicide. I mean, the whole point there was this was the come to the light side moment. This was him begging for what's good that's left in his son to come forward and come back to him. And the idea that, as Kylo Ren is saying, the words that obviously we all are interpreting as, oh God, it may be working. He may be coming over to the light side, even though we knew it wasn't really going to happen. The words there are giving hope that, hey, maybe he's seeing the light. And why would those words be followed up with Han killing himself? For the sake of his son. I don't even see why that would help Kylo in any way. So, and I was also going to comment that Han was really, really surprised when he got killed. He looked really surprised. He looked betrayed, shocked. Now, of course, maybe that's just the look that you get when you die. So even if he's committing suicide, maybe those looks were perfectly normal anyway. But I just don't see it. I think Andrew was off his nut on this one. But that is an interesting theory. Now, the other thing that Sarah Beth also says is she points out that, I apologize for typos. This was from my phone. Yeah, God, as much as I use my phone for everything anymore, I am actually considering being one of those people that puts the signature right there so that whenever I send anything from my phone, the signature just automatically says sent from my phone. Sorry about that. Because lots of people, there's just a standard message that just says sent from my phone, and often it's the name of the phone or the brand. So it's like the signature is this automatic thing that A, tells you it was sent from a phone. So yeah, it may be a little bit sloppy, but B, also is an advertisement for the phone itself. I would like for mine to just be a signature that it's funny, but it says, hey, this was sent from my phone, so I'm really not responsible for any typos in here. Something like that. But then I realized the problem with that is I use my phone for entering everything. I do it for, typing forum posts. I use it for sending email. I use it for replying to a million sorts of things, Facebook, whatever. And only on email does it actually append a signature to stuff. God, if I could just get to put that signature on everything that I type on my phone. God, that would be so nice. Because yeah, a lot of times, if I'm doing something really long or complex on my phone, a lot of times I'll go back and proofread it. But sometimes I just want to give a quick reply and the time it would take to go back and proofread and make sure that the autocorrect didn't screw me over again. I don't know. I as careful as I might be, I still miss stuff. So, man, it would be nice if everybody could know that, hey, I'm not really an idiot. It's my phone. I swear it's my phone. So you know what? Actually, from now on, those of you who read anything that I write ever, if anything in it looks really stupid, all right, typos, misspellings, completely use the wrong word, I have opinions that are idiotic, all right? Just assume that it's because my phone did that. What, did I say something good about Trump? Yeah, that was my phone. I'm sorry. I don't know what I was thinking. I should never post politically from my phone. My phone loves Trump. I don't know what the hell the problem is. Okay. Anyway, enough of that. You realize what we haven't even gotten to yet? It's time for the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast. This is the time for me when I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy week, I put it on my master list in my handy dandy pocket mod, and the best stuff off this list gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. So straight into my master list. First up, it's my science corner.
Oh, she blinded me with science.
She blinded me with science.
Blinded me with science.
And that music means if you don't walk away now, you might be in danger of learning something. Okay, for the last 2 weeks, I've been promising you I'll be doing this bit on Ann Selzer and statistics and polling data. And so that's what I'm going to do. Ann Selzer is a woman from Iowa. She lives in Des Moines, and she is a professional pollster, and she is known for being she's kind of a no-nonsense, down-home country-style pollster who has results that are very often very different from the majority of polling companies out there, and she's usually right, all right? And all the information I've got on Ann Selzer is from the 538 podcast, which I love, and from an article that I read on the 538 website. 538, Nate Silver's company and website, all about statistics. They start off with sports analysis and political analysis, and they've spread out to all sorts of things. And it is fascinating. So if you like numbers and statistics, 538 is your bag. I'm telling you. Anyway, Ann Selzer, she first came to prominence in 2008 when she predicted that in the Iowa caucuses in 2008, 60% of the people caucusing would be first-timers, people who had never done the caucus before. And she further predicted that as a result of that, although she probably didn't say as a result of, because I don't think she draws conclusions, she just presents numbers. So she said that 60% would be new caucusers, and she said that Obama would run away with the nomination in Iowa. And everybody said she was a nutbag. Everybody said that there's absolutely no way. No other polls were lining up like that. No one else was finding these numbers. And it turns out that she was exactly correct. Exactly correct. And why? Why? Because, and this is revolutionary, she does her polling. She calls people. She has a team of people. She calls people and she gets their answers, and then she reports the numbers that she finds. And that's it. And that's revolutionary. Because you would think, if you're naive like I am, you would think that, well, isn't that what pollsters do? They collect a bunch of numbers and then they report the numbers. Doesn't that make sense? But no, it turns out that that's not how most pollsters do it. Because pollsters, polling companies, are really afraid of looking stupid. Nobody wants to be wrong. Nobody wants to come up with this wild outlier result and then, come Monday morning be, well, or in this case, Wednesday morning, wind up being completely off base and be a laughingstock because, well, you were the only one that came up with that stupid prediction and look how wrong you were. And so they would rather fudge their numbers. And when I say fudge, that implies cheating, but it's not really. But I'll get to that in a minute too. But massage their numbers and bring them around to something that looks more like what everyone else is reporting, because that way, hey, at least if I'm wrong, well, everybody's wrong. All right. If I was off base, then look, we're all off base together. That, you know, if I'm going to be wrong, it's because of a surprise result that nobody possibly could have predicted. Okay. And so the way they do it, and this is just a small sampling of the kind of things that they might do, but the idea that, you know, you wait certain segments of your polls. So, for example, you know, if you think that in Iowa, this middle-aged demographic is more likely to actually show up, that they're more likely voters than others, then you'll take that middle-aged demographic and you'll give it more weight in your poll because, well, they're more likely to be there. So they're more likely to be overrepresented than the people who simply answer a poll. The ones that actually show up, well, let's give a little more weight over there. All right. Or, you know, if I poll and in my polling data, only, you know, 3% of my respondents were black, but I know that in the general population, 11% of the people in this area are black. Well, then, okay, let's give the black portion of my poll a corresponding weight. All right. And so we'll change it to match the actual demographics of the area. So now, the information I got from black people now counts for over three times as much as I actually polled it for. That kind of thing and stuff that makes sense. Okay. But there's lots and lots of ways to do stuff like that. And apparently for a lot of pollsters, there is kind of an art to it, a kind of a sense of, you know, feeling your way out and knowing that, okay, you know, this is, this is not really representative of what's going on. So let's kind of, you know, bring up the values that we know are important and and the idea is that a lot of times, whether it's consciously or unconsciously, a lot of times you get people who already have in mind kind of what the results should look like because they've seen everybody else's polls. They kind of know what previous things have said, and you don't want to be, again, you don't want to be crazy off base. So if you have options of how to weight stuff and you have options of what information to include, or if you have, you know, several different questions that ask the same sort of thing but in different ways, well, you're more likely to include the one that sort of is on track with everybody else. And so a lot of times it feels like people are they already have some preconceptions, and so therefore they choose the weights and the numbers that are going to fit the preconceptions they already have, which is a natural human tendency. That's something that we all do. We all look for confirmation. We all have confirmation bias. We look for, we seek out information sources that support things that we already believe because it makes us feel good. And so Ann Selzer is just unique in this sense because, no, she gathered the numbers and the numbers said something completely crazy, but, or at least from everyone else's point of view, something completely crazy, but hey, that's what I found, so that's what I'm going to report. And then she's right. She's not always right, but she is more often than not. And that's really, really impressive. Now, in the same vein, I'm going to take you over to the Fantasy Movie League for just a moment here, fantasymovieleague.com, where I play I've talked to you guys about Fantasy Movie League before, but the bare bones of it is I have 8 screens to fill my cinema, so every week we get a price list of here's all the movies, the top 15 movies that are out this week, and here's the prices for them. So I have $1,000 to buy up to eight movies to fill my screens. And then whatever box office those films make, that's the money I make, and whoever makes the most box office is winning. And so right now, oh man, Deadpool shot me in the ass. I've dropped from 275th, I think, to about 415th this week. So I dropped over 100 places because of Deadpool. But here's what happens in Fantasy Movie League is there is a wealth of numbers out there. All right. We have, you go over to boxofficemojo.com. Box Office Mojo has box office stats for movies going back 30 and 40 years. They actually have more than that, but they're really, really complete for the last 25 to 30 years, approximately. And so every movie, exactly how much money it's made every day, every week in its lifetime, how much they've made to the dollar, and it is fascinating to go swimming through all that data. It's incredible. And so you have something like this week, because you would think numbers would help you, all right? You would think you've got all this data. You should be able to predict fairly well what movies are going to do. Now, new releases, a little harder. It's hard to know exactly what the movie is going to be like before it comes out. It's hard to know exactly what people are going to think of it. Kind of depends on reviews and other factors. But you can dive into these numbers, and especially for returning movies, we look at something like Kung Fu Panda this week. This was my crowning glory for this week is that Kung Fu Panda and Star Wars. All right. I looked at the two of those and I made the prediction that, look, this week they're going to go up. This week they're going to do really well. And in fact, they're going to go up well enough that for the money you spend, it's worth my time to invest in, 4 Kung Fu Panda and 4 Star Wars. And that was my entire cinema this week. All right. And a lot of people spoke up and said, you're absolutely nuts. What makes you think they're going to go up? I'm like, okay, well, look, it's a 4-day weekend and it's Valentine's Day, President's Day. And if you look back at the statistics, because people were looking back, and here's the thing. If you want to look at, for example, Kung Fu Panda, look back at kids' movies. Well, they look back a couple of years and the most recent kids' movies going into this Valentine's Day, President's Day, 4-day weekend, the most recent kids' movies were SpongeBob 2, which sucked, and the Lego Movie, which was awesome. But both of those movies going into this Valentine's weekend, both of them dropped from the previous week. Both of them lost value from the previous week. The Lego Movie dropped about 9%. SpongeBob dropped about 30%. I can't remember the exact numbers. Maybe it was even more than that. And so my argument was, well, yeah, but see, you can look at those numbers, but if you look further back, you can look at these other numbers and see that things like Romeo and Juliet and Coraline and Curious George, all of them went up in the Valentine's Day weekend. And so, again, here's the matter of, this is where I tie it into with the statistics, with Ann Selzer, and the idea that, you know, you can gather your data, but you can pick and choose which data you're going to look at. And those who went into it thinking straight up that, yeah, look, Kung Fu Panda cannot possibly do as well as this. And then they went and they found the matches. They found movies, the comps, comparative movies. They found the comps that lined up with what they were already thinking and said, see, there's just no way. This thing's going to bomb. And I looked back further and my data, and maybe I'm guilty of the same bias, because I saw SpongeBob and I saw Lego Movie, but I also saw a whole bunch of other movies going back a dozen years. And I just thought the weight of evidence was, yeah, look, for a smaller movie, and at this point, Kung Fu Panda's down to, you know, it was, what, 20 million last week or something like that. So it's not at its peak. It's going into its, you know, third week. It doesn't make any difference. But I just saw that, you know what? I really think it's going to go up a little bit, or at least hold its value. It's going to be enough to buy into it. And it turns out I was absolutely right. All right. In fact, not only did it hold its value, it went through the roof at 26 million this week. I mean, it went way up. Huge. Star Wars. I said Star Wars is going to make 7.2 million this week. It made 7.5, or at least it's going to. The weekend isn't over. The numbers aren't final yet. But man, I was dead on with Star Wars. So you would think I've got a system that's working. I should be really proud of myself. But that's the problem, is every week in this game, you have to make a bunch of predictions, all right? There are 15 movies each week, and you have to call all 15 movies and come up with good guesses for how much they're going to make. And those were the only two I got. I mean, and I argued vociferously for them. I went out there and I told people, look, you know, because they kept challenging and saying, well, how can you possibly think this? And so I would explain over and over, no, look at this, look at this, look at this. I've got all the numbers lined up. They're all here. This makes perfect sense. So yeah, I nailed that. I was wrong about every single other thing going on this week in the movies. Every single one of them. I was way too high, way too low. Deadpool, I can kind of be excused because, hey, that was the outlier that caught everybody off guard. Oh, there were people saying, oh, it's going to do spectacular. But even the ones who thought Deadpool was going to do spectacular were saying it was going to do spectacular at like 120 million. And no, this sucker's up to 155. It's not only broken all records for R-rated movies, but it broke them way bigger than anyone even dreamed was possible. Deadpool is killing it. Have you guys seen Deadpool yet? Because I haven't, and I am dying to. I can't wait. I wish that my money was part of that $150 million that sucker's making this weekend, because I want to see Deadpool. And we'll talk more about Deadpool later on. I've got some nerd rage for you later. But anyway, the point I was making is that it is so easy to look at a big pile of numbers and think that, oh yeah, we know how to make sense of these. We can do that. But as we find out with this movie stuff, I mean, like I say, we have so many numbers available to us, so many years and years and years of data, and you can analyze it. I mean, it's not just how much money the movies made. It's how many theaters they were in each week. Did that number of theaters increase or decrease? What percentages are we looking at? What kind of weekend was it? There's so many factors that go into it. You know, for each movie is what genre is it in? What were its ratings? Now people are analyzing, they're going back several years and analyzing on Rotten Tomatoes. Rotten Tomatoes has a rating for the movie, but then also before the movie comes out, there's a number for what percentage of people want to see this movie and how many people voted to say they wanted to see it. And so people are looking at those and saying, okay, look, here were the predictions on this movie and here was the want to see rating on that movie. And this is the genre it fell in, the weekend it was coming out. And based on all of that, I think you can compare that favorably to this movie. I mean, you can go deep, deep, deep on this stuff. And you would think with all that data, there would be some systematic way to kind of – some algorithm that's going to pull this all together for us. But I think it's way beyond our puny human minds. I think it needs some much larger computational machine to take care of this for us. And I'm sure there are people out there doing it. And but, you know, by the professional – predictions that I see coming out, I don't think anyone's working really hard on nailing down exact box office from week to week. Because the professional predictions that are out there, there's several sites that do it, and I don't know where they get all their data from, but they don't come in any closer than any of us. I mean, honestly. It's a crapshoot. It's like playing the lottery every week. It's a scratch-off ticket playing this game. Because, yeah, every week you're going to get one or two things dead on. You're going to be exactly right. And the urge is to go out and start bragging to everybody else, going, I told you so. I told you so. And yet I was wrong about 11 other things. And the thing is on the one week where the things you were right about are the things that let you win the week, oh, man, it's like you've become God. I am all-seeing and all-knowing. And then the next week you find out that, yeah, no, it was a crapshoot. Look, and even on the week that I was right and it helped me win, yeah, I was right about those, but look at how close these other ones were or how far off these other ones were. I nailed down Star Wars and Panda this week, but I didn't see The Choice, which made way more money than I thought it should have. I certainly didn't see Deadpool going that far over the top. I didn't see some of the littler movies, which, you know, weren't really on my radar anyway, but they kind of dropped through the floor. Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies. I mean, I knew it would do bad. I didn't think it'd do that bad. You know, that kind of stuff. And so even though you have all this data and you think that means that you're pulling something valuable out of it, a lot of times, no, you're just already confirming what you already believe. And it's a lot of guesswork, and you can pick and choose data to your heart's content and come up with whatever set of numbers makes you happy. And it takes a lot more professionalism, to get around that and actually come up with something predictive, something valuable. And Ann Seltzer has found a way to do that. And again, she says it's simply by collecting data and then reporting what that data is. For box office predictions, okay, maybe that's a little bit too simplistic for predicting box office, but you know, maybe if we had polling companies, if box office receipts were that important as apparently, predicting primaries in South Carolina are, if it was that important to us, maybe we'd have polling companies that basically, you know, at the beginning of every week, Monday, Tuesday, called, you know, 3,000 households around the country and asked them, hey, you going to go to the movies this weekend? How likely are you to go to the movies? If you do go to the movies, what do you think you're going to see? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We could maybe compile polls that then gave accurate box office results for the weekend. But, you know, it's not worth anybody's time to do that every week. So, anyway, did I give you something educational there? I mostly just like talking about numbers. So, anyway, enough of the science corner. It's time for the pod people.
Pod people.
That's right. Talking about podcasts because I love podcasts. I like making them. I like listening to them. Podcasts are awesome. And I told you that Joel is leaving us. Joel is moving away to get a new job and be a big, important mucky muck. And good for him. But before he's left, he's given me another new podcast to listen to called TV Guidance Counselor with Ken Reed. And TV Guidance Counselor is fascinating. All right. Ken Reed is a stand-up comic, writer, actor, entertainer, and he owns every TV guide ever made. He has a copy of every TV guide ever made, which I think is amazing. And for his podcast, every week he brings on somebody and he lets them pick, hey, what era of TV would you like to watch? You know, you want to see something from the 80s? You want to see the late 60s? You want to watch, you know, mid 90s? You know, pick a year. We'll do something there. And then he will select an issue of the TV guide for them. And they get to take that away with them for a week or so. And that person will then go through the TV guide and decide, okay, what are we going to watch in prime time all week long? So from basically from 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock every night, Eastern time. What are you going to watch all night? And they do a week's worth. And so that person will come back. And then that's the whole show is Ken and the guest sitting down and talking about the week. What are you going to watch? It's September 1982. What are you going to watch? All right. And it's a nostalgia trip and it is entertaining and Ken knows so much about TV. I mean, I know a lot about TV. I love TV. I've been watching TV for years, right? And so I sit down to listen. And he knows, you know, as they start talking about various, you know, sitcoms from the 80s, oh, I'm all over that. All right. And so I know a lot of the things that they're talking about, but then he'll throw in tidbits, and then they'll actually have, you know, they've got the TV guide open to read the description, and they go to IMDb and they actually will read off the whole cast list. And, you know, they'll have all sorts of little interesting things about that. I know a lot, and it's nostalgic and fun to follow along with them, but then there's lots of stuff that I had no idea. That is so cool. Who would have guessed that, you know, that these shows had crossover, that this writer actually worked over there, or who knows what. And it's just a fascinating show. It's a lot of fun. The interesting thing that I just got out of the latest one I listened to, and I can't even remember which one it is, was he started talking about the TV Guide fall preview issue. I think this was the episode that he did with Ben Blacker, who was one of the writers from Thrilling Adventure Hour. And started talking about the TV Guide fall preview issue and how important that thing was. And I forgot about that. Those of you who are younger than I am who listen, when did they stop doing that? Were you guys there for the TV Guide fall preview? Because I remember this sucker every year. Every year when the fall preview came out, it was, look, all the networks are going to start their new shows in the fall. That's when new shows start. And the TV Guide would give you a list of every new show coming to the major networks that fall. And it would go through them, it would give you descriptions of them and who's starring in them, and then would give their recommendations on what they think is going to turn out to be good and what isn't. And as they're talking about the preview, the fall preview on the podcast, I was just taken back. I forgot how much I loved the fall preview because I got every one of them and I read them, and you would start planning your life according to them. You would see that there's a new science fiction show coming up, or a new sitcom coming up, or a whatever, some star that you like, and they're coming into a new show. And I would get so excited, and I'd start planning out, like, oh God, all right, that one's going to be Wednesday nights. I have to watch that. Wednesday night's a date. I have to make sure I start watching that. And you would lay out which shows you were going to see based on the TV Guide fall preview. Because we had no internet. That's why. And it was amazing. You lived and died by that fall preview. It was a way to make your plans. That way you could be the first one in on that show rather than not realizing it was there, and then 2 weeks in and all your friends are talking about it. Now you're playing catch up because there's no way to go back and watch those first two episodes until reruns come around in the spring. And now you're just lost. You wanted to be the first one in if the show was going to be good. And the idea that sometimes the fall preview would give you this description and they'd give it a recommend and you'd get in there and you'd be so excited, and then the show would suck. And it's like, oh, TV Guide, you just wasted it. I could have been watching, who knows what, you know, I could have been watching the new season of Family Ties instead of trying out this new show that was a waste of my time. I should have come up with more old TV references to just kind of pepper in here, so it made it look like I was really, really witty and on the ball while I'm talking off the cuff, but I'm not. So anyway, TV Guidance Counselor with Ken Reed, awesome podcast. I've listened to 4 or 5 episodes now, really enjoying it. And the other one that I'm going to mention while we're in pod people here is Getting On with James Urbaniak, which I've mentioned many times before. And the show is essentially a short story every time he does a podcast. And he's had a couple of them right in a row here recently, but sometimes it's months in between while he works on other projects. But whenever he puts out a new podcast, it's James Urbaniak, and it's a short story that he is reading, performing. And these short stories always feature, he does them in first person, and they feature him as the main character, who is always someone vaguely similar to him named James Urbaniak. And they're awesome. All right. Some of them are very touching, very moving and powerful. Some of them are horror stories. Some of them are just straight up humor. But they're always interesting. And I love Getting On with James Urbaniak. It is a great podcast. And the reason I bring it up is he just had one come out this week, and it is, it's a comedy one, and it's a guy, James Urbaniak apparently, who is explaining to you how he discovered that he is the son of Frank Sinatra, and it's amazing. And right in the middle, there is a quote. It may be the very best quote I have ever heard on any podcast, And I'm not even going to give you the context for it. All I'm going to give you is it's Urbaniak saying, there's an algorithm. There will be blood. Fig Newtons. It was beautiful. All right. And that little bit in context. Oh, it was beautiful. You guys really, you should listen to Getting On with James Urbaniak. Great podcast. Okay. Whew. We were all done with that section. Whoa. Uh-oh. Get the little ones out of the room. Make sure you're sitting down for this.
Nerd rage came flashing back. And I just looked at him and went, Rrr!
That's right. It's time for some nerd rage. Yeah, my rage this week is all about Deadpool. Because, not because Deadpool is killing me in the fantasy movie league. It has nothing to do with that. It is the idea that there are people out there who want a kid-friendly Deadpool movie. That they want something, they want, is there any way we can get an edit of this movie that's appropriate to show to our children? Because children so badly want to go see Marvel movies and superhero movies, and therefore, can't we have a PG-13 rated Deadpool? Isn't there a cut that we could show them that would be acceptable? And, first off, no, there's not, because if you did that, it wouldn't be Deadpool, so stop asking for it. All right. But second of all, then the complaint of that Deadpool is going to corrupt our children. Okay? And it's not phrased in that way, but it's the idea that look, Deadpool is a superhero with the Marvel brand name right on it, and therefore, when it comes out, lots of kids are going to want to see it, and it's not appropriate for kids. And lots of adults, because it's a superhero movie under the Marvel brand, lots of parents are going to assume that it's appropriate for their children and will allow them to see it, and this could be very damaging and harmful. Which, okay, first off, if you're a parent who is letting your child see a rated R movie because you thought, well, it's superheroes, it must be okay, that's on you, okay? That's completely on you. Second of all, and this is the hypocritical part that bothers the crap out of me, you know what else isn't appropriate for kids? If you're judging by that and you're the kind of parent who doesn't want your kids to see material that may be too adult or too challenging or, you know, stuff that they're just not emotionally ready for at that age, whatever the reason. There's very good reasons for that. There's stuff that I don't let my kids see until they're older, and that's fine. But let's start with Dark Knight. I mean, yeah, look, Dark Knight, with the second one with Heath Ledger's Joker. I mean, he's a crazy person. He is a psychotic who, I mean, is responsible for all sorts of horrific violence and psychological torture. And, I mean, when he slams the dude's head down on the desk and puts the pencil through his eye, that was horrific. That was horrific. That was not meant for 11-year-olds. That was not meant for kids. That was wildly inappropriate. And yet, it's okay in this country because, well, it's just violence. And violence is okay, all right? And suddenly, we have Deadpool coming out, and everyone's all up in arms about Deadpool, and Deadpool gets rated R. But here's the deal. Yeah, Joker's fine. What? Because, he may have violently murdered a bunch of people and the psychological torture and the other bizarre, awful, terrible stuff that he does. But, you know, he didn't use a lot of swear words. He didn't talk about sex. There wasn't any nudity. So therefore, yeah, let the kids in. PG-13 is fine. All right. Because PG-13, by the way, means, yeah, parental guidance suggested under the age of 13, but PG-13 doesn't stop anyone from getting into the movie. So they don't need to have parental permission or parental guidance to get in there. And everybody is welcome to come in and give their money to see the Joker freak out on people. All right. But now, suddenly we have a real rated R film because, well, it's got sex and nudity in it. So therefore, rated R. Oh, yeah. He talks dirty. Rated R. And now people are upset because, well, yeah, but there's going to be a blurring of the line here that, you know, what's appropriate for kids, what's appropriate for adults, especially, you know, when they're all superheroes with Marvel on them. Well, how are we supposed to protect our children? Yeah, you know what? By being an informed consumer. If you are willing to send your kids to a rated R movie without looking any further at the content or why it might be rated R, you're willing to just give it a pass because it's a superhero movie, you're a bad parent. you need to be looking further in that. Nah, hold on. You're a bad parent. That's awfully judgmental. But no, if you are the kind of person who will do that, then you don't have the right to complain afterwards that there was inappropriate or offensive material in your opinion. Because, you know what? The R rating should have been your warning. And therefore, you need to do that research. If that is important to you, you need to be knowledgeable about that. You need to look up why it has an R rating. I mean, look, we went through this with animation in general, all right? Remember when The Simpsons first came out? Maybe you don't. I do. I saw the first Simpsons Christmas special. I saw The Simpsons back when they were on the Tracy Ullman show. And I remember the first season of The Simpsons was, which was also Fox, by the way, ironically. All right. Is that part of the definition of ironic? I have no idea how to use ironic anymore. But the first season of The Simpsons was controversial. And people were up in arms. They protested it because, well, yeah, but it's a cartoon. It's a cartoon that shows children being disrespectful to their parents, telling their parents off, the kind of stuff that you have seen in other venues. But this is a cartoon. And cartoon kids shouldn't act that way. And cartoon adults shouldn't act that way. And the idea was that The Simpsons was incredibly offensive and dangerous to family values because it's a cartoon that's not kid friendly. All right. Despite the fact that Simpsons in itself lampoons with Itchy and Scratchy, lampoons the kind of violence that's already allowable in cartoons, the kind of things that is already considered acceptable in cartoons up to that point and always had been considered acceptable, when clearly is that the kind of lesson you want to be teaching your kids? Is that what you want them to see? And yet Simpsons, because Simpsons puts it into a different context, that's something that's just beyond cartoony violence and into actual family situations, and suddenly Simpsons was offensive. I mean, it was really offensive. That was the thought. Because it was a cartoon and cartoons are meant for kids. All right. Similar to, yeah, look, it's a superhero movie. Superheroes are meant for kids, which is not always true. Obviously, look, there are some superhero movies. We've seen Watchmen. We've seen, there's been other R-rated superhero movies, out there. But this is the first really mainstream one. Watchmen is kind of a special case, but Deadpool is really, really pushing it right over the top. All right. And just like that, cartoons were considered to be kids' fare, and thus to make something adult oriented in a cartoon, well, that's a breach of protocol. You're corrupting our children because, well, it's a cartoon and kids will watch cartoons. But look, if you thought Simpsons was bad, then came along South Park, all right? And this is, and again, these are not the only examples. There was Duckman, brilliant and subversive Duckman, years ago. And yet it didn't get the mainstream attention, and so therefore, we didn't see all this before. I mean, there's always been examples of animation that have been geared towards adults, but it was never mainstream until we got to Simpsons, and then after Simpsons, South Park, and South Park broke it open, all right? Because of South Park, Simpsons is considered tame now, all right? Nobody bats an eye at The Simpsons. Simpsons has been around for 25 years and doing their thing. It's normal. It's family fare, all right? But South Park came along, and South Park suffered the exact same outrage because, well, cartoons are for kids, all right? Cartoons are for kids, and here's these really, really awful, horrible characters doing awful, horrible things that are not appropriate for children in any way. And it took us a couple of decades to get over that. I mean, now, we've gotten to the point where we accept that animation can fall in any genre and aim at any demographic. And we're all cool with that. All right. We've all seen Adult Swim. We've all seen all sorts of adult-oriented cartoons. I mean, Seth MacFarlane's Bread and Butter is Family Guy and American Dad and that terrible Cleveland show. And, you know, that we've seen that there is a place for animation that is aimed only at adults, that's not appropriate for children. And that's fine. Okay. Well, now superheroes needs the same treatment in the mainstream. In the comics themselves, we've known for decades that there are adult comics and there are kids comics. And the mainstream superhero comics haven't really been kids material for years and years and years, and nobody recognizes that. I mean, most of them are PG, PG-13 if they were to be translated into movie ratings. So it's not like most of them are full of nudity, sex, swearing, extreme gore, violence, et cetera, et cetera. But some of them are. All right. And comics have been that way for years. All right. And now it's just getting to the point where the movies are catching up to where the comics are. And Deadpool, yeah, Deadpool is going to raise a lot of controversy right now. And there's lots of people who want to complain about it. But look, Deadpool is the superhero movie version of South Park. All right. This is the one that breaks it wide open and says, yeah, here it is. Deal with it. Because this is what comics have been about for years, or at least some of them, a significant segment of them, is for adults only, and we enjoy them. We love them. It's art, all right? However you want to define art. This is – and so this is what breaks it open for that adult, because there's going to be imitators. There's going to be so many imitators, and most of them are going to suck horribly, but that's fine. Because that's what happens. But Deadpool, apparently Deadpool is awesome. My son and his lovely fiance would have finished watching Deadpool 10 minutes ago, and they haven't yet called me to tell me how awesome it was. I've been taunting him. I had to call him because they knew they were coming out for Valentine's Day to see Deadpool. And I had to call him, Friday morning, I think. And I was like, dude. You know, almost 1 million people have seen Deadpool already and you haven't. How does that make you feel? Because he loves Deadpool. He's always loved Deadpool. And he's like, stop, just stop. Why do you do this to me? I can't. And now he's seen it and I haven't. I would have thought he would have called to rub it in, but he hasn't yet. So have you guys seen it? It's awesome, isn't it? Oh man, I knew it would be. All right. Don't tell me. No, don't tell me anything about it. I don't want to know. I don't know when I'm going to get to see it, but if I have to avoid spoilers until it comes out on DVD, I will. But I'm really looking forward to Deadpool. It's going to be great. All right. We've done enough of that. It's time for the Pod-O-Matic. Hot dog. This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble, and he rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that is where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? You send your question or topic to me by email, or better yet, in a private message on my forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. I will add it to my Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. All right, and my first number is 37. And if I get this sucker on over to here, there we go. 37 is from Humongous. And Humongous says, what would your ultimate game room look like? Oh, how many times have I thought of this? I don't know for sure, because I have seen the dungeon-style game rooms. You go down there to play Dungeons & Dragons, and it looks like a medieval, if not a medieval dungeon, at least a medieval castle, the interior with your big stone walls and your light fixtures that look like torches mounted in the wall and that kind of stuff. And that's all pretty cool. All right. I don't think my game room would look like that. Mine has to be brighter and happier because I play more than just Dungeons and Dragons down there. I'm not down there, you know, LARPing vampire all the time. So, although, you know, some days I would be, I've never played vampire and anyway, doesn't matter. But I wouldn't rule it out. That's what I'm saying. But my game room would have to be happy. It would have to be positive and brightly lit. And I would have a big gaming table, but not too big. I mean, I want my gaming table to be comfortable enough for 8 people to sit around it. And then if we need more than 8 people, we'll squeeze some chairs in and we'll find a way to make it work. But I'd like it to be comfortable enough for 8 people. But I'd also, man, if I could have a couple of smaller tables off to the side, because here's the thing. I got the big table. This is, look, by the way, when I win the Powerball, this is what's going in my mansion, just so you know. I need the big table for big role-playing games. When I've got 6-7 people at the table, we're all here. This is the one we sit at. And that sucker will be the nice table that has slightly raised edges, reverse bevels, I don't know what you're going to call it, but a slightly raised edge to keep the dice from flying off unless you're a complete tool. It's going to have some compartments or drawers or inserts in front of each person, so you have a place to set stuff that you don't want other people to see right away. You know, a little drawer for your dice or your pencils or just a little insert that you've got places to put your stuff. But everyone fits around the table. Everyone has a good old time. But then also around this gaming room has to be at least two other tables because we're going to be playing other stuff. And sometimes you want a board game that's just four of you and the big table is too much. Or sometimes you just want a board game or a card game or something that's just two or three of you and this big table is too much. And so I would like tables that can accommodate that, or that if we decide to have a bunch of people over, that we have enough room for three or four games to be going on all at once. You can put two people on the big table, and then you got a couple of, or two games running on the big table, and then two little tables off to the side. We've got enough room to fit a bunch of people in comfortably, okay? Now, that's just the table and chair setup. All right, there's also got to be some comfortable reading space, all right, at least some big comfortable sitting device, maybe a couple of recliners, maybe a small couch, but something where if you're just going to be down there just perusing my gaming materials, you can pull something off the shelf and just sit down and start reading. And again, everything's going to be well lit because I don't care for the mood lighting. I'm getting old. My eyes are getting old. I need to be able to see stuff and I need bright light for that. But there's got to be some comfortable reading space down here. And then shelves. There's going to be shelves all the way around because everything I own is going to be on display. All of my games will be out there somewhere. And if I have enough money for this game room, you can trust I've got three or four times as many games as I have now. All right. There's going to be shelves for board games and shelves for war games and shelves for card games and shelves for all the RPGs. There's going to be two shelves just for Pathfinder junk alone. All right. And then, oh, old D&D stuff. And then, oh, all the other role-playing games that I'm not playing anymore because I still play Pathfinder all the damn time. And, you know, a shelf for all of my games that I've written myself and I now have the money to have self-published in hardcover versions with beautiful binding and beautiful cover art I've paid for. That would be awesome. All right. So all my stuff can be spread out. That's really the main requirement. Okay. Now, what will the exact decor be? I think it's going to wind up being an eclectic mix of all the nerd stuff that my wife doesn't want in the rest of the house. So, will there be superhero posters and movie posters up? You bet there will be. All right. Are there going to be collectible action figures from every genre stuck on the ends of shelves and on little special glass displays? And yeah, everywhere. You bet there are. And is any of it going to tie the room together with a specific theme? No, it's just going to say nerd, baby. That's what it's going to say. That will be my ultimate game room. Now, to make it even better, the ultimate game room also needs to have a snack nook. Okay. Now this is not a full kitchenette because the theater room has the full kitchenette. Okay. But it will have a snack nook. So a little recessed area where I've got some shelves with snacks and, you know, a little counter space for preparing stuff, but nothing big. Obviously, look, there's going to be a fridge down there. And I don't even know if it'll necessarily be a full size fridge, but it'll be a half size fridge, right? Not quite mini fridge, but bigger than that. So there's enough down there for some cold drinks and, you know, the dips and the whatever other stuff needs to be refrigerated, but it's not going to be huge and complicated. All right. But that's my snack nook and, a bathroom that is directly off the game room so that there's going to be a door over here that just leads straight to a bathroom because for God's sake, you don't need you wandering all the way through my house to go find a bathroom. And by the time you get back, Jesus, we've been waiting on your turn forever, dude. Where have you been? All right. And yet, no, there'll be good soundproofing so we don't have to hear you pee. Don't be self-conscious about it. It'll be fine. Okay. So that's what my game room will look like. Yeah, the theater room is going to have the full kitchenette at the back. That's the best. We stayed, for my 40th birthday, we stayed in a cabin in Mahoney State Park, a 20-person cabin. And it was massive and it was gorgeous. And downstairs they had their version of a game room because there's this huge TV on one wall with all sorts of couches and chairs. So there's plenty of room in front of this giant screen TV, plenty of room for, you know, easily 10 people to comfortably sit and watch movies here. And then behind that was the pool table and the ping pong table and the foosball table. All that stuff was available to you. And this whole giant open area also had a built-in kitchenette and a bathroom at the back. And the built-in kitchenette had a full stove, refrigerator, plenty of counter space, plenty of cupboard space. It was enough of a kitchen for this cabin because there was a full, beautiful, bigger kitchen upstairs. But it was enough of a kitchen downstairs that that could have been all the kitchen you really needed. But we had two of them. So my movie room, which will not be too far from my gaming room probably, but my movie room will have the same kind of setup, not with the foosball table and all that. That'll be a separate game room. It'll be right next to the gift wrapping room. But sorry, that's a joke that I took from Frasier, that they were wandering around Niles's gorgeous apartment and they couldn't believe how big it was. It's like, wait, where's the library? Well, it's right past the gift wrapping room. Where are you? Okay. Anyway. Now you have the huge screen that fills one wall. You have all sorts of comfortable seating so that you can get a good 12 to 15 people in there all comfortably watching this movie together and having a great time. And then behind that at the back of the movie room is the kitchenette so that you can actually go back there and get drinks and prepare snacks and never have to take your eyes off the screen ever. And then at the back of that next to the kitchenette, again, bathroom for convenience. Bathroom positioned such that if I'm all alone, I'm the only one down in the movie room, I could actually go in there and use the bathroom with the door open and not miss anything on the screen outside. Although, oh, you know what? For convenience, maybe I should just have if you're in the bathroom with the light on, there's a screen in there that lights up with whatever's showing on the big screen out front so that while you're in the bathroom, you don't have to miss anything. Oh, that's genius. That's definitely how I'm setting it up. If the door is shut and the light is on, boom. Bathroom screen lights up. You're not missing the movie at all. Perfect. Okay. But that's irrelevant to my game room. That's my other room. Again, boy, don't you guys want me to win the Powerball so I can do this? I'm ready. I've got plans, man. All right. 53 is from, hold on. I don't know how to scroll. 53 is from, oh, it's from Mrs. Darks. And Mrs. Darks says, hold on, number that sucker. I can't find anything here. Man, I'm bad at computering. Okay, Mrs. Dark says, do you find yourself speaking with an accent after conversing with someone who has that accent for a while? Yes. Oh, and sometimes it's embarrassing, sometimes it's not. But it is, if I talk to my parents, I will, while talking to my parents, I will start using a Southern accent to some degree while I'm on the phone with them, just because that's how I talk to my parents. It's a process called code switching, which I just recently read several articles about because I found one and I found it so fascinating that that I kept looking up more stuff about code switching. The idea that people use different dialects in different situations. From the kind of dialect that I would use just hanging out with my friends, a bunch of adults while we're playing games. And, it will be very casual and it will include lots of jokes and more swear words than usual and that sort of thing, as opposed to the dialect I would use in a professional setting at work, especially with people that I'm not as familiar with, which is also different from the dialect I would use while in Texas hanging out with my family in public. You switch your exact choice of words, your exact accent. And it's called code switching, that you can change from situation to situation. And where they highlighted it was people from Appalachia. And they're by far, not the only ones that do this, but an Appalachian accent is considered by the majority to sound uneducated and stupid. And so therefore, they talk about how when they go home, or when they're talking to their parents on the phone, they slip right back into the old childhood accent and it's very comfortable for them and they like talking that way. And just because that is the dialect you use, it doesn't mean that you're stupid. It doesn't mean you don't know what you're talking about. It just means that's the way you talk. But it sounds stupid to other people. So in a professional context, they've learned that they get better results when they switch it up to a more professional, quote unquote, dialect. And, the quote unquote for the professional, not for the dialect. Anyway. And so they talk about code switching and I actually, it's written down on my master list in my handy dandy pocket mod. Let me get that sucker out. Where did I write down code switching? There it is. Yeah. And all right. And with code switching, there were lots of really interesting replies to these articles online. the comment section was full of people who talk about code switching, how they do it not just with their not just with their native accent and professional accent, but also that it happens to them a lot, and they find themselves in whatever situation they're in, just automatically picking up that accent, automatically subconsciously imitating the people that they're with, just because that's what they do. And I can relate to that. All right. And okay. But before I get to that part, the other thing that they commented on was that there were lots of people in the comment section who said that, look, I'm from Appalachia and I'm proud of my accent and I don't temper it for anybody. This is the way I talk. And if they can't deal with that, well, that's their tough luck, blah, blah, blah. But as I'm reading it, I'm like, yeah, but you're not doing it here. I mean, granted, writing is different from speaking, but it's like, look, you very clearly, you know, when you want to highlight a point, you switch over to Appalachian dialect in your writing, and I can hear it in your writing that it's, you know, they're not going to intentionally misspell stuff Mark Twain style to give across that regional accent, but just in their word choices, when they say, when they want to give an example of their Appalachian dialect, they will switch their word choices and their grammar, their word order, and things change up. And yet, that wasn't how they wrote the whole rest of this piece. They had three paragraphs where they didn't do any of that. Three paragraphs where you wouldn't have been able to tell they were from Appalachia, like, except that they told you they were. And then at the end, they switch it up just to prove a point. I'm like, okay, well, if you're code switching here, then how can you be self-righteous about the fact that you claim to not code switch in your real life? I don't think people can help it. I think we all do it. And I do it. Again, I'm bad about it. It took me a while to notice when I was doing it and to figure out when it might be insulting to somebody, because we had a bit, this was 20 years ago, but through the church, there were some new families that had moved to the area. And so we went to go meet up with them and kind of help them out because they're brand new and they don't have any idea what's going on. And it's Christmas time, that, you know, these are migrants who had come here, you know, to work in the factory here or to get other work, and typically Spanish speaking households. And so the family that we met with, the dad spoke a little bit of English, but the rest of the family didn't speak much at all. And so, you know, we went over, we met with them, we helped them out with some stuff, we did it. And as I was talking to one of their kids who was, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years old, little kid, and my wife pointed out that I was starting to take on a Spanish accent, a Mexican accent while talking to him. And I was embarrassed. I was humiliated. I'm like, I did. And I started thinking about it. I'm like, oh my God, I was doing that. And it was not in any way intended to mock or whatever. I just instinctively, and that's the worst part, is the kid wasn't even talking to me. All right. It's not like I'm hearing, Mexican accented English here in the room with me. And thus I'm imitating that. I just started doing it. And again, this is 20 years ago. And that was to me the turning point where I'm like, okay, I have got to be more conscious of this and I have got to stop doing that because that could be really insulting to people. I mean, again, if I'm going to pick up the Texas accent because I've been there, because I grew up with Texas parents, I've had that accent at times off and on in my life. You know what? That one's acceptable. But anyone else, I'm just making fun of them and I don't mean to. So I got to really be careful about that. Anyway, does that answer your question? Let's see. Yes. Yes, that does. And again, I'll still find myself doing it, but not nearly to the degree that I used to, because I'm more self-conscious about it now. 92. And this is going to be our last one. I know, only three, but yeah, boy, I went way long in the meticulously plotted portion. So 92. Oh, it's from my son. This one's from Elijah. Elijah says, if Mercury isn't the element Mercury, okay, the planet Mercury isn't, okay, this is his question. If the planet Mercury isn't made of the element Mercury, why do we call it Mercury? Oh, well, that is a great question, because they're both named after the god Mercury, also known as Hermes, which, is who Hermes Conrad from Futurama is named after, just to put it in a context that Elijah is going to be familiar with. The god Mercury, or Hermes, was the messenger god, or god of speed. And so therefore, the planet Mercury is named after Mercury because it is the fastest planet. It is the one that, I don't know if fastest is technically correct, but it is the one that goes around the sun the quickest. So it only takes 90 days, 91 days, to make 92, whatever it is, somewhere in the 90s, to make it around the sun, whereas it takes us, obviously, 365. So because it is the quickest to get around the sun, we called it Mercury. The element Mercury is also named after the god Mercury, but because Mercury is also called Quicksilver, it is something that is silvery and metallic, so like silver, but it is in a liquid state at room temperature, and thus liquid metal was known as Quicksilver. Quick, I'm assuming, referring to its liquid state, but I'm just guessing. But as a result of that, that Quicksilver became Mercury, named after the god, because of its, I guess, quick, ephemeral nature. I don't know. But something like that. So, I can't tell you exactly why the element Mercury is called Mercury, but it was named after the god, but I can tell you exactly why the planet is, and that was it. So there you go. All right. That is the end of our Podomatic. Thank you, R2. And now I'm going to turn it over to GLaDOS, and she will give us a summary.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2016 by Nerd Pride Radio. The opening and closing theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. And my bumper music this week was She Blinded Me With Science, as performed by William Shatner. All the bumper music I use on my podcast is available on iTunes. You check these out, buy them, enjoy them. I wouldn't put them in my podcast if I didn't love them. You want instructions on how to make your very own pocket mod, like the one I'm holding here in my hot little hands? You go to pocketmod.com. If you want to do something nice for my podcast, subscribe to it. Write me nice reviews. I love nice reviews. Like me on Facebook. Come over and hang out. But more than anything, recommend it to other people. Tell your friends about it. If you enjoy it, why wouldn't you spread the word and let other people enjoy it as well? Remember, I am always looking for you listeners to do my work for me, so don't forget to send me questions and topics for the Podomatic. Watch out every week on the forums for nerdprideradio.com/forums or on Facebook for my listener betrayal segment. If you have a really interesting nerd fact about an upcoming episode number, or you want to tell me a possible sponsor, co-host, what Nerd Pride Radio smells like for the opening, go ahead and send those in. If I get them from you, trust me, I'll use them because I hate doing my own work. My contact info, mike@nerdprideradio.com, @nerdprideradio on Twitter, facebook.com/nerdprideradio. But to be totally honest, the very best way for you to talk to me is to come over and sign up for my forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. You sign up there, send me a message. We will hang out together and become best friends in the world. We'll have fun. Now it's time for listener betrayal. At the beginning of every cast, I go out onto the internet to my forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums and on Facebook, and I put up listener betrayal, and I let people know that I am recording. If you want to add to this podcast, post it up while I talk, and at the very end, I'll come back and read off whatever you have put there. So let's venture right in and see what we've got, starting with my website. There's only one, and it's from my brother Kyle. And Kyle says, so, you do any hardcore fucking this weekend? Oh, dude, seriously, what kind of question is that? You are, oh, man. All right, here's what we did do, all right, is as we do every Valentine's Day, we leave our children and we go off and we have a weekend to ourselves without any interruptions. And this year, we went up to Sioux City and We went out and did a little shopping. We went to the Hard Rock Cafe, where we had dinner, a beautiful four-course dinner at the Main and Abbey restaurant in the Hard Rock Cafe. And it was actually really good. Really good. Really expensive, but it was a great experience, and we had a really good time. We enjoyed each other's company. We enjoyed being there. After we got done with our beautiful four-course Valentine's supper from their special Valentine's menu, where I ate oysters, by the way, for the first time, and they were pretty good. Grilled oysters. Awesome. And we went from there. We actually just walked out of the restaurant straight into the Hard Rock Casino, and we came in with $200. We left with $217. So that actually worked out really, really well for us. And here's the deal. I was not in any way expecting to spend $200 in the casino. We were not going to go in there and blow $200. We just had a bunch of cash on us because we didn't know what would come up during the weekend. We wanted to be prepared for anything. Anything we don't use just goes right back into the account when we're done. But when we got into the casino and we sat down at the penny slots, which are penny slots are horribly named because they don't, there's no penny anymore. When you do penny slots, yeah, you're only betting one penny per line, but you have to bet 30 lines at a time on these slot machines. And they're actually, if you get the right one, they can be entertaining and fun. We had a great time. I love doing these. And so the minimum bet is 30 cents, and you can bet all on the quote unquote penny slots. You can actually bet $3 at a time on the machines we were using. Some of them let you do even more than that. But we wound up playing penny slots, and so we each had a $20 bill to start with. And so we pop in our $20 bill, and then Lisa turns her $20 into $53. And I mean, she hit just a bigger jackpot and said, well, shoot, $53. You know what? I'm going to cash this one out. So she cashes it out, puts it in her purse. That one's done. We're not touching that money anymore. That's just money we're going to walk home with us at the end of the night. And I wound up turning my $20 into $33. I hit a big jackpot. It took me from 20 to 33. I'm like, okay, I'm done. Let's cash that one out, put it in your purse. She got another one for like 30-something bucks. She put that in her purse. And then I lost $20, so I just went through a whole $20 bill. So, okay, that's fine. And then she turned yet another one into like $51 and put that in her purse. So we just kept, you know, the whole deal was, well, as long as we're making money, let's just pull out $20 bills, turn them into something larger, put those away. So when we got done with the night, we wound up, we each had two 20s that we didn't turn into anything. Those two 20s disappeared. But we still had, we had four of them that wound up turning into actual cash. And so when we left, we wound up with more money than we started with. And we must have spent 2 hours in there, had a great time, and spent no money on it. In fact, made enough money to take a little bit of the edge off of supper. So that was pretty good. And then we went back to the hotel where we were going to watch Trainwreck. We even brought our DVD player with us, because it's just, you know, it's one cable, plug it in, go. We brought our DVD player with us and we figured we could watch Trainwreck, and then, you know, if we get done with that and we want to watch stuff on Netflix, we could watch Orange is the New Black because it's all right there on our DVD player. And unfortunately, we brought all of that, but I forgot to pack the remote control, and the DVD player has two buttons on the outside, eject and power, and that's it. So without the remote, it was dead in the water. So we wound up finding other stuff to watch and do. And there was a hot tub right there in the room, so we got to relax, and it was beautiful, and we had a great time. And then this morning, on the way back, we ate at Bob's Bar in Martinsburg. Bob's Bar, which has the largest portions of any place I've ever been in. Yeah, I mean, we wound up, ordering our food, and Lisa said she wanted, do you have tater tots? I'll take some tater tots. And the woman says, a full order? She goes, oh, I don't know. How much is that? And she says, yeah, no, that's way too much. So Lisa says, okay, a half order? She goes, no, that's still way too much. You want me to just give you a handful? We'll just work it out. And I'm like, hey, you know what? I love tater tots as well, especially if you can get them in a restaurant where they're good and crispy, fresh made. Love some tater tots. I said, tell you what, skip my fries. Why don't you give us that half order you're talking about, and we'll just split that? She's like, sure you can eat them all? I'm like, really? Yeah. Well, at this point, I have to see them now. There's no way I'm not seeing what a half order looks like. A half order would have been a meal by itself for me, and I wouldn't have been able to finish it all. A half order of tater tots was a lot. I think it was a pound. I think it was a pound of tater tots. And oh, and they were crispy and hot, and they were really, really good. But it was a lot of potatoes. So, and then she ordered the gizzards, full order of gizzards, and it was, as I put on Facebook, it was more than four Lisas could have eaten, and it really was. I mean, she got through maybe a fourth, maybe a third of this plate of gizzards, and now we've just packed the rest off, so she'll have some for supper tonight, and maybe some to bring home to the kids, or maybe some for lunch tomorrow, or there was a lot of damn gizzards on that plate. And then I order the Bob's Big Burger, which everybody in the world has told me that, oh, you have to go to Bob's Bar. You have to get the Bob's Big Burger. You got to try it out. This burger is as big as your plate, which is probably about true. It was a regular size hamburger bun with a burger that is easily a good 8 inches across. I mean, this gigantic burger with this tiny little bun on it and one little piece of cheese in the middle. So I wound up cutting off the edges of it and just eating that like a ground beef steak. And then I had a burger left over when I was done with that part. And it was all really good. We had a great time. And the people there, I mean, the place is a dive. It is from the outside, looks like boarded up windows. There's no lights. It's like, is this place even open? I don't know. And then we got inside. Sure enough, they were open and it looks like a bar and it looks like an old rundown bar. But they were so nice. They were all so sweet. There were a couple of women working in there, and then Bob himself, who didn't come out and talk much. He was busy with stuff. But the ladies came out and made conversation with us, and they were just, oh, it was so pleasant. It was just a great place to eat. I don't know how often the health inspector ever makes their way out there, but damn, Bob's Burgers. Not Bob's Burgers. That's a cartoon. Bob's Bar. Awesome place. So we had a really good time. Like I said, people have been telling us for years we have to stop there, but you know. It's not like it's exactly close to our house, but it happened to be – we took a little bit of a detour, but it happened to be pretty close to on our way home. So we made time to go in there today, and it was wonderful. So that's how I spent my Valentine's weekend. If you want to be crass about stuff, then you know what? You describe your own weekend. But me, I had a lovely, lovely time with my wife, and we reminded ourselves of how much in love with each other we are. And it was very sappy and sweet, and we just had a really pleasant time. The whole weekend was wonderful. And it's just sad that we have to come back to, you know, she's got lesson plans to do yet, and there's homework to help the kids with. Unfortunately, I'm avoiding all that by recording a podcast instead. So I'm still having a great weekend. But that's it from my website. Let's see if there's any listener betrayal out on Facebook. And there is. And hold on. And, oh, all right. My wife says she has 7 more kids left to do lesson plans for. 7 more. Man, it's taken her a while. I'm going to go up and join her in just a minute. But anyway, hey, look at this. There are a lot of replies here. The first one is from Nellie. And Nellie says, Happy Valentine's Day. Any special plans today? Well, I've already given you everything that we've done. And now the rest of my weekend is going to be just relaxing. We will probably, after she gets her lesson plans done, we're going to come home and probably watch Trainwreck tonight, which I'm really looking forward to. I mean, like we have – the choice is Trainwreck was her pick, and then my pick was Mad Max Fury Road because I wanted to get it because, A, I want to see Mad Max again, but, B, my wife has never gotten to see it, and it's not necessarily a great Valentine's movie, but I can't wait to watch it again. I'm so excited to see that one. But Trainwreck tonight, really want to see Trainwreck. I've heard such good things about it. So anyway – Nellie continues, I just started painting minis. I have seen some of your pictures of the miniatures you're picking up, and I am in love with them. They are spectacular, Nellie. I hope I've liked all of them that I've seen because they are really cool. I forgot how much I love actual real miniatures and especially painted ones. And I don't necessarily miss the painting. I mean, I did that for a long time when I was a kid, and it's something that I don't have quite the time for now, but maybe someday, you know, when life isn't as hectic, maybe I'll do it again. If my hands are steady enough, maybe it would be a relaxing way to spend time. But anyway, She says she's loving it. I would never play Minnie's games. It's never appealed to me, but I love painting. Have you ever tried? I think I just answered that. But yes, when I was a kid, we had – see, now here I make fun of the concept of, well, here's my gaming room and here's my movie room and here's my gift wrapping room. But when I was a kid, and when I say kid, I mean 15 years old, my brother and I – in our third floor suite, my bedroom had the kitchenette in it. We had our own private bathroom up there. We had a gaming room and we had a miniatures painting room. Okay. A room specifically for painting miniatures in. That's all it was used for. That was just an artifact of the fact that we were huge nerds, who spent our time doing lots of nerd things. And we had the entire third floor of this house to ourselves to do whatever the hell we wanted with. And that's what we chose to do with it. We painted miniatures for a while and I still have maybe 8 or 9 of them left over of the ones that we painted. I still have a bunch of those left, not all of them, but 8 or 9 that we painted. And I know we did a lot more than that, but those are the ones I have. And then I have a handful of unpainted ones from those days that we never did get around to, but are still pretty, and I love having them. So, and then there is a reply to this one from Sarah Beth, who agrees with me that those minis look amazing. And oh yeah, yeah, and Sarah Beth says congratulations on the green card. Congratulations! Oh, Nellie's official. Nellie can work and travel. She could even leave the country and come back. Oh, these are all big things that I take for granted. Not that I've ever bothered to try and leave the country and come back, not since Japan. But if I wanted to, I could. So, you know, hey, congratulations, Nellie. Seriously, I'm really, really happy for you. Sarah Beth then has her own post where she says, hey, Mike, winter has finally arrived in upstate New York and with a vengeance. How has your winter been? Okay, first off, I've been to winter in upstate New York. I lived 9 years of my life. So I've had 9 winters in lovely upstate New York. And I specifically had my winters directly off of Lake Champlain, which means that we had lake effect snow. And there were years where, yeah, it buried cars and it was, I mean, tragic stuff. Now, the difference between upstate New York on Lake Champlain winter and Nebraska winter is the cold. Yeah, I know it gets cold up there, but I didn't get to negative 50 degrees until I got to Nebraska. All right, 50 degrees below zero. I never saw that until I got to Nebraska. And then maybe it's different in other parts of New York, but I know that when you're on the lake is a huge body of water that kind of helps mitigate temperatures. So you don't get as extreme highs on average in the summer. You don't get as extreme lows in the winter on average. And there are exceptions, obviously. But it does help temper that, which is nice. The coasts have the same thing with the oceans. It helps temper some of those temperatures a little bit. Whereas out here on the Great Plains, no such luck. Now this winter has not been bad. We had one blizzard, which shut down school for 2 straight days. And then we had a separate minor snow that we just had a late start for school that wasn't bad. But it did allow me to get my snowblower back out, and I was so happy. My snowblower has been broken for a couple of years, and we knew it was broken, but there was also no severe weather coming, so I was in no hurry to get it fixed. What happened to it? The blade of the snowblower snapped off at the axle. So the axle and the blade just kind of separated from each other, but only on one side, so the sucker would still spin, but that side would getting kind of floppy and wouldn't actually scoop snow. And I assume it's because I hit a chunk of ice or something that got wedged in there and caused that to snap, which is a shame. And so now we knew the blizzard was coming, and so I went out and I bought myself some JB Weld, because JB Weld, it's like welding but in liquid form. And the package tells me that it will stand up under 3,900 pounds of pressure per square inch. Therefore, it certainly has to be able to handle a snowblower, right? Okay. So I took a chance on my JB Weld, which I've never used before, but man, it sounds like it should work, right? And so I got my thing, my snowblower set up. I got everything lined up. I got the JB Weld on it. I'm basically super gluing my snowblower back together. And as I'm doing it, there is no way that this could possibly work because I'm just super gluing my snowblower back together. That's not how you're supposed to fix things. And yet it turns out that's exactly how you're supposed to fix a snowblower because it works like a charm, baby. Oh, man. And so we wound up getting the 12 inches of snow here, and it was bad. And I wound up chopping right through it with my snowblower. Everything's fine. Got it all cleaned out. Very, very happy. So, and now we're going to have 50s all this week. So we still have some leftover snow on the ground. This is actually the first time in many, many years that we have had snow on the ground for, you know, 2-3 weeks in a row. I mean, usually you get warm enough days that it all melts off in the middle, and then you get another snow, and then it melts off. This is the first time in years that we've had 3 straight weeks of white ground. It's been 2 weeks since that blizzard. I haven't been able to get my a couple of my cars out over there. So this week I'll be able to get them out and park them on the street. That'll be nice. So it's not a horrible winter, but yeah, we had our first run-in with real winter here a couple weeks ago, and it's been pretty heavy. So, and now it's going to be gone. But that's only the first sentence of Sarah Beth's post. She also says, what's your all-time favorite time of day? Let's see. My favorite time of day would be, I would say, evenings, lately. I mean, last couple of years, maybe, because evenings after about 7:30, that if we've got obligations for other stuff that we need to do, they're usually over by 7:30 or 8. You know, supper's done, homework's done and checked over, and now we have time after 7:30, 8 o'clock. We've got an hour before Noah has to go to bed, and so if we're going to be, you know, watch something on TV as a family or play a game together or even if we're all just, you know, in our own separate corners reading a book or doing whatever we're going to do, goofing around on the computer, checking Facebook. But that's the relaxed time for us, is on most days. Now, weekends are obviously different, but on most school days, that's what happens is, you know, it's busy, busy, busy. And then in the evening, you get through all that. And oh my God. All right. You can hear, you heard the guinea pig scream over there. Yeah. There they go again. Oh man. The other day, after all my talk about these guinea pigs and, because I've talked about wanting to kill them for ages, right? You guys have listened to me. And the other day, I don't remember why I was out here, what I was doing. I can't remember anything. All I know is that all of a sudden one of the guinea pigs started sneezing, and it sneezed like 6 or 7 times over the course of 3 minutes. So it was clearly either it had something jammed up its nose, you know, they have sneezing fits like anybody else, or what I thought was it's getting a cold. And the last time we've had every time we've ever had guinea pigs get a sneezing cold, they've always wound up dying of it. They get upper respiratory stuff, and they wind up dying from their upper respiratory infection. So that's – I'm not going to yell at him. I'm not going to go over there and silence them because he started sneezing. She started sneezing. They're both girls. She started sneezing, and I mean – my heart dropped. It sank. And I'm like, oh God, they're not going to die. And I'm like, and it took me having a real moment there to go, oh, apparently I do care if they die. Damn it. Damn it. And now I can't be such an ogre about it. I felt it was kind of revelatory. I feel weak now. I'm weak. I should just go drown them. That's what I should do. But no, I was actually worried for them and I didn't want them to die. So, and because also when one of them dies of something upper respiratory, yeah, you can get them separated right away. But by that point, you know, by the time one of them starts sneezing and hacking, the other one's already caught it. And that's how we've lost, I think, 3 guinea pigs over the years is upper respiratory infections. And it's very sad and very painful. And so I was really worried for them. And it turns out that was over a week ago. And it turns out they're fine. They, whatever it was, I mean, that sneezing, it was that 5 minutes and then it never happened again. So it must have just been dust or something. You know, she aspirated some water. Who knows what she did, but they were fine. So, but it turns out that I do care about the guinea pigs and I actually have a heart. So, I hate having to admit that, but it's true. All right. Still back to Sarah Beth. Last night I had a really great listener betrayal question because I worry you get bored with the small talk that I usually come up with. But then the power went out and I started trying to figure out what to do if it didn't come back before the house got too cold and I forgot my question. Darn it all. Oh, that's why I have a pocket mod, is because for me, I mean, there are so many things during the course of the average day that I think to myself, oh, ooh, I bet I could talk about that on the podcast. Oh, yeah, I could. And then whenever those come up, I mull them over for a little bit. I've got the luxury of going, okay, no, that's something good. I need to write that sucker down. I'm not sure it's worth it for you to carry around a pocket mod all day, every day, just for the occasional listener betrayal question. But, you know, I'm not recommending it, right? So, yeah, I know exactly what that's like. The idea that – especially when you come up with the idea of ideas. For me, it would be the idea for a game. I'm like, oh, you know what would be a really cool game? You know what would be a really cool comic book? You know what would be a really cool – and I'd have this or short story idea or whatever it is. And I'd develop it in my head and I'd put in all this thought time while I'm driving somewhere usually or while I'm falling asleep at night or in the shower or wherever it is that inspiration strikes. And you have this great idea and you think to yourself, wow, that is amazing. And I think, oh, maybe I should go find some place to write this down. And I would always tell myself that, because going to find some place to write it down would take so long that, you know, like I'm in the shower, I would have to get out of the shower. I'd have to go find a notebook or get my computer. I'd have to actually type up these ideas. It's like, no, look, this idea is so amazing and so spectacular. There's no way I could ever forget it. There's no way I'm not going to remember this next time I have some time to start writing things. And then inevitably, I would always wind up forgetting it. Okay. For example, right now, and now fortunately for me, always have the pocket mod. And if I have to pull over to jot something down, or again, I've done this to Lisa, I've done this to Aiden, I've done this to Jacob. There will be many times that as I'm driving, we're having a conversation, I will pull out my wallet, get out the pocket mod and hand it to them and go, okay, write this down for me because I can't forget it. But I have in my pocket mod and I almost – this idea was so good, I had to write it down because there was, I mean, it was one, an idea that there's no way I could ever forget this idea, but just in case, I better write it down. And so I wrote it down and it says, hands. That's the only word I wrote, hands. So now as I'm getting ready for the podcast today, I'm staring at the word hands for a good 5 minutes. I have no idea why I wrote hands. And then I remembered what it was. And I'm like, oh my God, that really is the best idea. I need to add the word undead to this so that next time I look at it, I won't forget what it is again. And it's a brilliant idea. And I just need a little time to develop it. And maybe I'll never use it, but maybe I'll throw it at my players in a game. Maybe I'll save it for some kind of short story, or, you know, maybe I'll just never use it and it'll just be something cool I tell people about. But undead hands is, it was really, really cool. So anyway, yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. And then the next and last message is from my mom. Aw, my mom says, how awesome are Mike and Lisa? Aw, well, we are spectacular. You've seen the great weekend we've had. You've already looked at all the pictures and I just got to tell you about it now. And my wife is spectacular. We had such a good time. I am so glad we get to do this every year. Because it was fun, and we need that time alone. Every once in a while, you know, you get so busy with stuff that a little time away where there's no pressure. That's the best part about this, is we almost always wind up getting a room with a hot tub, and whenever you get a hotel room with a hot tub, there's always a TV conveniently positioned so that you can lay back in the hot tub and watch a movie. You can lay back in the hot tub and watch whatever. And the idea that we get to wherever we're going and we get to relax, and it's not just that there's no pressure on. It's like there can't be any pressure on, because even if there was something for us to worry about, well, there's nothing we can do about it till tomorrow. And so therefore, it's the ability to just completely switch off every other responsibility and pressure in your life and know that, look, for the next 24 hours, we've got nothing else to do but just spend time together. And it is wonderful. I absolutely love getting to do that every year. So Valentine's Day is our day to do that. And it's spectacular. So yeah, thank you, Mom. Yeah, we had a wonderful time. So that's the end of my podcast. Happy Valentine's Day. Go watch Deadpool. Don't forget to check out TV Guidance Counselor. Don't forget to check out, Getting On with James Urbaniak. He just put out the new episode just now. And, you know, oh, check out my friends, Angry Geeks Versus podcast, the Me Like Trivia podcast, the, I haven't plugged, my friend Dave's Sphere Ensemble album. Go get Sphere Ensemble's Divergence. Spectacular album. Is there anyone else I'm not plugging for? I'll get around to them next week. I love you guys. You guys are amazing. Thank you for being here for me. I will see you next week.